any kind. 2 weeks? 3 at most? 3 weeks lost in love floating through the days? Not that he wasn't working. It was September now. Everyone was working. Every farmer in the province was cloud-watching, working with one eye on the sky, wondering if the rain could possibly hold off until they got the crops in. The whole region was up to its neck in oats. Everyone who could be spared was helping with the harvest. So Arthur was living in a haze of work and love, and the weeks slipped by. All this time, Jake was busy with his own affairs, whatever they might be. Arthur hardly saw him. If he happened to be home during the half-hour Arthur and the boys took to eat their supper, Arthur would see him then, but that was it. After supper, they went out again, working until it was too dark to see, and then went to bed. Jake was back at school. The cheating incident of the previous year had been forgiven, and he was now doing his senior matriculation to their mother's joy. According to her, the whole world was waiting for boys who had their senior matriculation. Particularly, Arthur thought but didn't say, if they were excused from going to war. All the jobs that would have been filled by all the boys who were never coming home would be open to Jake. Arthur suspected that if Jake hadn't had a cast-iron excuse for not signing up, he would have concocted one. Fighting for his country wouldn't be Jake's idea of a good time. But there was no comfort in that. No army in the world would accept Jake. If you looked at him from behind, you could see there was something not right about the shape of his spine. The walk to and from school each day was as much as he could manage. Laura had started school as well. Arthur didn't like to think of her as a schoolgirl sitting at a desk, sticking up her hand to answer questions. In his mind, she was a woman. He wanted her to be at home and to know that she was close at hand.
"How does Laura seem to be fitting in at school?" their mother asked.
Jake didn't hear her. He was flipping through last week's copy of the Temiscaming speaker.
"Jacob?"
"Yes?"
"How does Laura seem to be fitting in at school?"
"I don't know. Okay, I guess."
"Isn't she in your class?"
"Yes."
"Well, you should help her, Jakey. It must be very difficult starting at a new school, not knowing anyone. You should introduce her, make sure she gets to know people. She's shy, you know."
"I don't know her, Mum."
"Yes, you do. Of course you do."
"I've met her once. That isn't knowing her."
"Well, you should get to know her."
There was a teasing tone in their mother's voice that Arthur had never heard before.
"Don't you think she's lovely, that hair of hers, and she has such a sweet face?"
Arthur froze, mid-chew, a lump of potato in his mouth.
"You know," their mother said, "it might be nice if you invited her to come around here after school one day."
Arthur waited, motionless, his eyes on his plate. The potato had glued itself to the roof of his mouth. It, or what his mother was saying, nearly made him gag.
"Don't you think that would be a nice idea?" his mother said.
No reply from Jake. Arthur had to see his expression, so he looked up. If only he hadn't done that. If only he had just stayed as he was, swallowed his potato, kept his head down. If only. But he raised his head just fractionally, just an inch or so, and the movement caught Jake's eye, and Jake, who had been on the point of saying something irritable to their mother, you could see it in his face, paused and looked at Arthur curiously and said, "What's the matter?" Right then, as he felt the slow flush spreading over his face, as he saw Jake notice it, saw the light dawn, saw him smile, Arthur knew what was going to happen. He saw the whole thing right then. Chapter 11. Ontario to initiate certified swine policy. Youthful drivers banned on tractors. Temiscaming speaker, June 1960.
"Your daddy was the good boy," Jake said. I was the bad boy.
Ostensibly, it was Julie he was speaking to. It was dinner time. Since Jake had arrived, meals at the farm were a lot more entertaining. There was no denying that.
I was always getting into trouble, Jake said.
Julie was watching him from her place across the table, and Ian could see that she wasn't sure whether he was being funny or not.
I wasn't any good at anything, you know, any of the farm jobs. I couldn't have milked a cow to save my life. But your daddy, by the time he was your age, your daddy could milk two cows at once.
He stretched his arms out to the side as far as he could without knocking off March's head, clenched his hands around two imaginary teats, and pulled down one hand after another, making a hissing noise like milk spraying into a bucket. Julie decided that was funny and giggled. March was looking sideways up at Jake under the shadow of his arm.
"Oops," Jake said. "Gotcha, March. You're all covered with milk."
March looked down in consternation.
"He knew every cow by name, didn't you, Art? There was Daisy and Maisie and Millie and Lily and Polly and Dolly. Dozens of them. And your dad was on first-name terms with everyone, whereas I'd be out behind the barn trying to burn down the fence posts. Remember the fence posts, Art?"
Arthur gave a fractional nod. Jake's presence hadn't noticeably enlivened Arthur. If anything, the reverse. Jake rattled on with his stories of the good old days, and Arthur just sat chewing his dinner, his eyes on his plate, saying not a word.
"Your daddy didn't approve," Jake said, winking at Julie. "He tried to scrape off all the charred bits. He kept trying to save me from myself, didn't you, Art?"
Even Carter was listening, Ian noticed. He didn't slam out of the house the minute he'd finished eating like he used to. He stuck around listening to whatever Jake might have to say.
"He didn't manage it, though," Jake said mournfully. "To save me, I mean. I was a lost cause."
He let his voice trail away sadly, and Julie giggled again. For the first couple of days, Ian had thought it was a real bonus having him there, an emissary from the outside world, proof that it really did exist. But by the end of the week, he was starting to feel that he wanted things to be as they'd been before. Jake's presence changed things. The place felt different with him around. More interesting, but less relaxing. Even the routine was altered. Arthur didn't take his full half-hour break after dinner, for instance. Spring was a busy time, of course, but even so, the midday break had always been sacred. No matter what, Arthur, Ian, and the old man used to retire to the armchairs as soon as they finished dinner for what Laura called digestion time. In the early days, Ian had tried to help her with the dishes, but she had looked quite shocked and said that he must sit down and digest his meal. He'd seen that it was part of the natural order of things, and that was how she wanted it. Now, though, Jake sat with them, leafing through the Temiscaming speaker and reading out the bits he found funny, which was just about everything, and it seemed to get on Arthur's nerves.
"Cheese factory works 3 shifts," Jake would read. "Now, if that isn't earth-shattering news, I don't know what is. Here's another one. This'll interest you, Art. Memorials. Mid-June sale, special 10% discount till end of June. Isn't that great? You can stock up on tombstones. Keep feed racks in your pastures." Do you keep feed racks in your pastures, Art? "And if not, why not?"
After a few minutes of this, Arthur would heave himself to his feet and say to Ian,
"Well, gotta get back to it. No need for you to come just yet, though. You sit for a bit."
And off he'd go back to the fields. So Ian could have sat on with Jake, but it didn't feel right having a rest while Arthur was working, and anyway it wasn't restful. When Arthur went out, Laura allowed Julie and March back in. Normally they were banished from the room during digestion time, and they wandered around chattering and asking for things and getting under Laura's feet. She was snappy with them, and even more so with Carter. Carter had always gone out to the barn straight after lunch to fiddle with his bike. It spent more time in pieces on the floor of the barn than it did on the road, but now he stayed, listening to Jake, and for some reason this irritated his mother. She'd say, "Carter, would you get on with things, please?" and he'd get up reluctantly and go out to do whatever task he had been given. As for Jake himself, he seemed perfectly at ease. Ian couldn't imagine what he found to do all day. Mostly he seemed to follow Laura around, talking to her as she fed the chickens or hoed the row crops or made up a mash for a sick calf. It seemed to Ian that his presence flustered her. There was a tension in her movements that he hadn't seen before. And she didn't look at Jake when she replied to his questions. She seemed to keep herself permanently half-turned away from him. The more Ian saw, the more he was convinced that Laura didn't like Arthur's brother. Ian liked him fine. The only thing he wasn't keen on was the way Jake hung around Laura. That was starting to make him uneasy. He wondered what Arthur thought of it. But Arthur didn't seem to notice. The way he kept his head down nowadays, he probably didn't even see. Late one afternoon, March found a baby rabbit under a bush by the corner of the barn. By some chance, the dogs were off on an errand of their own.
"Catch it!" March shrieked.
He threw himself at the bush, and it exploded with rabbits, baby rabbits everywhere. They leapt about in panic, then headed for the safety of the long grass that bordered the woods. March ran after them, yelling, "Wait, wait!" But they were gone. For half an hour, he combed the grasses, searching, calling softly for them. Ian, who was in the farmyard rubbing down Robert and Edward before turning them out to the pasture for the night, went out to him. "They've gone to find their mother," he explained. "They were too small to be without her. She'll have taken them into the woods where it's safe." March looked at him, tragically. "Don't you want them to be safe?" Ian said, tousling his hair. "If they stayed around here, the dogs would eat them. Wouldn't that be terrible?" Jake watched the whole thing with amusement. "Sentimental little guy, isn't he?" he said, when Ian came back. "Must take after his mother. I don't recall Art ever crying over a rabbit. He'd shoot him and stick him in a pot." He was sitting on the stump they used as a mounting block, swatting flies with a yellow plastic fly swatter. He'd taken to joining Ian there at the end of the day. It was kind of flattering until he remembered that he had nothing else to do. "Yes," Ian said, "he does seem to take after Laura." He had finished grooming Edward and just started on Robert. Grooming was a long job like washing a bus, but one of his favorites. There was real pleasure in seeing the rich, dark glow of the horses' coats emerge from under the dust and sweat of the day. And they loved it, and were appreciative, nuzzling him with their noses from time to time.
"Any of the kids going to be interested in taking over the farm, do you think?" Jake said.
"I don't know." He paused, thinking of Carter. "Carter might. Maybe March, too. He likes the animals." Robert nodded him with his nose. "Get on with it."
"Carter," Jake said. He seemed to find the idea amusing. "Not a chance. I haven't seen him out in the fields once."
Ian didn't reply. He was remembering Carter's comment about Arthur never letting him do anything. He wondered suddenly if Carter would actually have liked to be working out in the fields beside his father. Strange that Arthur always gave him kids' jobs around the farmyard. In a way, it was a shame they didn't have a tractor. Carter would have been really good with that. He was good with anything mechanical. He loved Jake's car, though, unlike Jake, it was the engine he was interested in. Jake didn't seem to care about engines. It was the style that mattered to him, Ian thought. The image.
"Anyway," Jake went on, "I reckon the communities up here are doomed. They're being drained of their lifeblood."
He swiped the fly swatter at a horsefly and it wheeled away.
"Meaning the likes of you and your friends."
"You think they're going to turn into ghost towns?" Ian said. He couldn't imagine it. Couldn't see Struan deserted, stores boarded up, dust blowing down the street like in a Hollywood Western.
"Not necessarily ghost towns, but a lot smaller than they are now. Which, damn that thing, I'd forgotten how infuriating they are."
The horsefly was back, circling around him just out of range of the fly swatter.
"Which will mean even fewer jobs, so even more young people will leave, and so on. A slow decline."
He ducked down, and the horsefly came to Ian instead. Ian maneuvered himself so that he was within reach of Robert's tail, and the fly went back to Jake. Struan's still growing, Ian said. My dad has so many patients he's going nuts, especially in the summer, tourists rolling in poison ivy and getting fishhooks in their ears and stuff. And during the hunting season, rich southerners shooting each other in the tail. Or during a measles outbreak. There were some pretty sick kids in Struan at the moment. Ian kept an eye on Julie and March, but so far they'd both escaped. Catering to tourists is no kind of life, Jake said. He abandoned the stump and went over to Edward and ducked down beside him. The horsefly landed on Edward's shoulder, and Jake brought the fly swatter smashing down on it. Edward swung his head around and gave him a baleful look.
But it's not only tourists, Ian protested.
Suddenly, it seemed important to him that Struan continue to exist. He might not want to live in it, but he definitely wanted it to be there.
There are other things, like people are always going to need lumber, so they're always going to need the lumber mills. And if you got a lumber mill, you need men to work there, so you need the town.
Somehow I don't see you working in a lumber mill, Jake said. He sat back down on the stump. As for your dad, he's way too good a doctor to be stuck up here. He should be down south. He could be earning 3 or 4 times what he's earning here, working half the hours.
Ian had thought the same himself from time to time, but now that the idea was voiced by Jake, he found he didn't agree. His father wouldn't be happy in some city down south, no matter what they paid him.
I think he just likes it up here, he said.
Well, maybe, Jake said. But it's kind of a waste, don't you think? Someone with that much ability, treating people's sore throats.
Ian concentrated on brushing the area of Robert's shoulder where the collar was inclined to rub. He knew Jake meant it as a compliment, but he was offended that anyone would see his father's job in such a light. Being the only doctor in a huge area, on call 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, handling every emergency, the nearest hospital hours away, how could anyone consider that a simple job? It took at least as much skill as being a specialist in a big city with a hospital full of fancy equipment. His father was important to the people up here. He played a big role in their lives. Didn't they deserve a good doctor?
The more Ian thought about it, the more offended he was.
But Jake must have sensed what he was thinking, because he smiled suddenly and said,
"Don't get me wrong, I think your dad's admirable, devoting his life to the people up here. He does a great job, I know that. I'm just biased. I've always thought that if God had meant us to live in the north, he wouldn't have given us the brains to find our way south."
In the evenings, Ian and Pete went fishing. Like always. Sometimes they explored, testing out the bays along the western shore of the lake, but that wasn't serious fishing. That was to find good spots to take tourists. Pete was having a busy summer. At the beginning of the season, a lawyer from New York who regularly hired Pete's grandfather as a hunting guide had asked the old man if he would take him and some of his friends pike fishing. Pete's grandfather passed him on to Pete, and now the word had got around, and Pete was in high demand. So high, in fact, that he was having to pass on some of the requests to his friends on the reserve, or he'd never have time to fish himself. The tourists paid good money, which was great, of course, but according to Pete, the main reason he was happy to help them out was that then he could control where they fished. He wanted to keep them away from Hopeless Inlet. Hopeless was where the phantom muskie had his territory, and Pete didn't want anyone else to catch it. He was still after that fish. They hadn't seen a sign of it in more than 2 years, but he was convinced it was there. Ian was starting to doubt it. The two of them had covered every inch of Hopeless, every marshy river mouth, every point of land, every reef, and had worked their way along the shore for miles in both directions without a whisper of it. In that time, Pete had caught several very big pike, but he insisted none of them was the fish that had nearly pulled him out of his boat.
"How do you know?" Ian asked more than once, clambering up onto the thwart, knees around his ears trying to keep out of range of the teeth of the 20-pound monster flailing about in the bottom of the boat. "How do you know this isn't him?"
"He's not big enough."
"Not big enough? You're out of your mind."
Pete was up on a thwart, too. He tried to subdue the pike with a paddle, but it had knocked it out of his hand, and now he was fending it off with an oar. There was blood and water flying all over the boat.
"This is just a pike, man. He's not a muskie. He couldn't pull me out of the boat."
"Sure he could," Ian yelled. "You were off balance."
"I was sitting down. How can you be off balance sitting down?"
"He's a figment of your imagination," Ian said. "He's taken over your brain."
"He's there, man. He's right down there. I can feel him."
In fact, it made no difference to Ian where or why or how they fished. He was in love with fishing, never mind that all he ever caught was snags and sunfish. There was something about being out on the water, the silvery, ever-moving surface hiding God knew what life and death struggles underneath, the long stretches of peacefulness that might or might not be broken at any moment by a burst of savage excitement. You could think during those long stretches, or better still, you could not think, though lately he had to fight to keep the thoughts at bay. Always the same thoughts, his future, what he was going to do with his life, his own indecision, was driving him insane. He wished he could be more like Jake in that regard. Whatever his other failings, Jake did have an admirable philosophy of life. He summed it up in two words: don't sweat. His life had been extraordinary, it seemed to Ian. He'd left home on the spur of the moment, and with nothing at all, no money, no plans, no high school certificate, none of the things they told you were essential. He'd bummed his way around, to start with, getting a job when he ran out of money, leaving it when he'd earned enough to move on. He'd picked peaches in California, worked as a blackjack dealer in New Orleans, been a short order cook, an encyclopedia salesman, the manager of a classy bar in New York. Most recently, he'd had his own company, something to do with real estate, and had just sold it for a tidy sum. He wasn't sure what he was going to do next, he said. He had a couple of ideas he was playing with. His whole life sounded like a fabulous game, and he made it sound so simple. "Just let things happen," he advised, clapping Ian on the shoulder. "It's the only way to live." As if it were easy to do what he had done, to leave the well-marked path, resist the pressures, defy people's expectations. It took courage to do that, courage and imagination. Ian was starting to think he didn't have a grain of either. "Could you get me a rabbit?" he said now to Pete, pushing the thoughts aside yet again. The pike was subdued now, gasping in the bottom of the boat, occasionally smacking its tail against the floorboards. "Preferably a baby one." Both Pete and his grandfather had trap lines, so it was feasible.
"What do you want a rabbit for?"
"For March, Arthur's kid. I thought maybe I'd build him a hutch."
Pete twitched the jig, waited a moment, then jerked it hard, and a smallmouth bass broke the water 10 feet away, its body arcing gracefully.
"I could get you a dead rabbit,"
he said, hauling in the line. The bass fought furiously, showering them with spray.
"A live one was more what I had in mind."
"If it was dead, you wouldn't need a hutch. He could carry it around, hang it around his neck. It would never run away."
He caught the struggling bass in his hand, removed the hook, smacked its head on the gunwale, and dropped it into the bottom of the boat.
"What did you say his name was?"
"March."
"Is that like March, April, May, or like forward March?"
Pete was positively garrulous nowadays. The Mounties had given up trying to find whoever was responsible for Jim Lightfoot's escape and had finally left the reserve.
"He's named after his grandfather. Laura's dad is Reverend March."
The poor old guy was still hanging on. He had everything the matter with him, but Laura looked after him so well he was going to live forever. Pete skewered a minnow on his hook and dropped it overboard.
"What's the kid want a rabbit for?"
"A pet."
They fished. High above them, 4 turkey vultures circled slowly on the last thermals of the day, waiting for something to die. The Queen Mary rocked gently in a swell that had originated hours ago and miles away back in somebody's past. Pete said,
"A dead one would be best, man. You could skin it and eat it and then stuff it with feathers. It would look just like the real thing."
"I think he'd know." The previous night, Ian had sat down and drawn up a list of every career he could think of, everything from a geologist to a chimney sweep. Then he started crossing them off one by one, starting with doctor, the plan being that there would be a few left for him to think seriously about. The problem was he'd crossed them all off. Every single one fell into one of three categories: predictable, boring, or ridiculous. "Have you decided what you're going to do?" he said to Pete, startling himself because he hadn't intended to ask until he'd made up his own mind. "When?" Pete said. "For the rest of your life." "Oh, yeah." Ian looked at him in surprise. "You have? When?" "A while ago."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"I've been waiting for you to make up your mind, man."
"Well, tell me now. Maybe it'll help me make up my mind."
"No."
"Why not?"
"You have to make up your mind first."
"Why?"
Ian was starting to get annoyed.
"Have you told Mr. Hardy?"
"Nope."
"Look, just tell me, okay?"
He didn't want to play games about it.
"Soon as you've made up your mind."
They fished. Irritation scratched Ian's insides. There was a faint tug on his line. Pete said quietly, "You got something." Ian held his breath. There was something there, all right. He waited for the count of three, then jerked the rod backward hard. There was a savage yank from the other end. The rod arched over, the line screamed out of the reel, and a second later, a long, smooth, streamlined shape shot out of the water 20 yards away, sailed up into the air, twisted right around so that its head was almost touching its tail, and was gone. The slack line drifted on the water like weed.
"Shit," Ian said.
"He was a nice one," Pete said admiringly. "I didn't set it hard enough. Shit.
He was smart, man. He knew exactly what to do."
Which was a generous thing to say. They fished. Ian's heartbeat slowly returned to normal. The evening air was fresh and cool. He felt better, despite losing the pike. That was the thing about fishing. It was almost impossible to stay wound up for long. The shadow of a vulture sailed across the water. Pete said, "Did you know vultures piss on their legs to keep cool?"
"You're kidding,"
Ian said.
"Nope, it's a fact."
"How'd you know?"
"Ancient tribal lore, man."
"Really?" Pete twitched his jig.
"No, I read it somewhere. Some book by some scientist guy."
"Oh," Ian said, disappointed. He would have liked it to be tribal lore.
"Well, how would he know?"
"How would he know what?"
"That they piss on their legs to keep cool. Maybe they're just lousy shots, can't pee straight."
"He could know that they piss on their legs, but how the hell could he know why?" It was a serious question, but it struck Pete as funny. He started to laugh.
"What's funny about that?" Ian said.
He looked up at the vulture soaring on the wind, and suddenly it came to him, a newly minted thought.
"I've got it," he said. "Holy shit, I got it. I know what I'm going to do. At last, I know what I'm going to do."
Pete stopped laughing. He reached under his seat, pulled out a bottle of Coke, and prized the top off on an oarlock.
"What?"
he asked suspiciously, taking a swig.
"I'm going to be a pilot."
It was so perfect, he was astounded that he hadn't thought of it before. He'd never even thought to put it on his list. It was totally different from what everyone expected of him, and on top of that, it was a good job. Interesting, respected, well-paid, the lot. Not the Air Force, though. He'd be a commercial pilot and see the world. No one, not his father, not his teachers, not even Jake, could disapprove. Pete choked and Coke shot out of his nose. He started laughing again.
"What's so funny?"
Ian said. But that only made Pete worse. He howled with laughter, rocking the boat, offending the vultures who wheeled away on the cool evening air.
"Think you'll come back here in the summers?" Arthur asked. They were sitting on a granite outcrop in the middle of a field of wheat, drinking tea. The sun was hot, but there was a breeze which made it just about perfect. The horses were standing head to tail under a couple of trees at the side of the field, politely swatting flies for each other with their tails.
It had been so long since Arthur had spoken that Ian looked at him in surprise. He was very quiet these days, even by his standards. Ian thought about the question. The closer he came to leaving, the more he saw that he was going to want to come back fairly regularly, not only for his father's sake, but also for his own.
"I think I probably will," he said, "next summer anyway."
Both of them were watching the wheat. The breeze brushed over the top of it like a vast and careless hand, making it roll and sway, hypnotic as the sea.
"Don't suppose he'll want to work on the farm, though," Arthur said.
"Would you have work for me?"
"Sure."
"You don't think you'll want to get someone who could be here weekends as well?"
"Ain't too many people want to work on farms nowadays," Arthur said, "especially not too many who are good with horses."
"Do you think they'll remember me?" Ian said. "The horses, I mean."
Such sentimentality. He was glad Pete couldn't hear him. It was Arthur's turn to look surprised.
"Of course they'll remember you. They'll remember you, same as we will."
Absurd how pleased he was to hear it. Jake said, "And then there's women. You interested in benefiting from my vast experience?" Both conversations took place on the same day. If you compared the two brothers physically, Ian reckoned, stood them side by side and studied them, you could just about see that they might have a gene or two in common. Their eyes were the same color, for instance, and both had quite fair skin. But if you could get inside their heads, tunnel your way into their ears, and take a look at what was going on in there, you wouldn't think they were even the same species. He gave Jake what he hoped was a man-of-the-world grin. 18 years old and still a virgin. If by some terrible chance Jake discovered that, he just plain wouldn't believe it.
"Sure." "Point one. They're wonderful," Jake said. "You have to give them that. The world would be a boring place without them. But point two, they're out to get you. All of them. They can't help themselves. It's biological. Their goal in life is to tie you down."
Ian nodded, thinking of Kathy. You could imagine Jake having trouble with women. He was a very good-looking guy. Laura chose that moment to come out into the farmyard. She gave them both a wave and headed for the barn. Jake and Ian watched her. Jake said thoughtfully,
"Though there is the occasional one you might not mind being tied down by, right?"
He looked at Ian and raised his eyebrows suggestively. Ian smiled uncomfortably. He didn't like Jake talking about Laura like that.
"I'll tell you something," Jake said. "As you get older, this is your Uncle Jake speaking, as you get older, believe it or not, the idea of settling down starts to have a certain appeal. Like the other evening at supper, I was looking at Art, sitting there like a sack of cement, like he always does, Laura waiting on him hand and foot, and I thought, you know, if you look at it a certain way, you could say that my dear, dumb ox of a brother has it all."
Here was the sum total of what Ian knew about Jake, almost 2 weeks after he'd arrived at the farm. He was 35, he'd never been married, he lived in Toronto, Calgary, San Francisco, New Orleans, New York, and Chicago. He liked New York best and reckoned he'd go back there. He thought Cadillacs were the only cars worth owning. Considering how much he talked, it was remarkable how little he revealed about himself. But a couple of days later he said,
"Actually, I just split up with someone. We've been together 3 or 4 years, I guess. She was a looker and nice enough, but, you know..."
He shrugged. He looked moody, which was unusual. It made Ian wonder if it could have been the girl who had ended things. Maybe that had something to do with why he was here. Maybe he'd come home to lick his wounds. Ian was halfway around the point in the canoe when he heard the bell on the dock clanging wildly. It was Saturday evening, and he and his father had just finished supper. He turned the canoe around and paddled back fast. Jerry Moynihan was on the dock, jigging impatiently from one foot to the other.
"Car accident," he said, hauling the canoe up on the dock almost before Ian got out of it. "Margie's arrived, but your dad needs you too. 4 people hurt pretty bad. Ambulance in New Lascard's coming, but it'll take a while."
The two of them were running up the house. Jerry Moynihan was panting, his paunch heaved up and down as he ran, not quite in sync with the rest of him.
"Who are they?" Ian said. "From around here?"
He could hear screaming now coming from the house.
"Tourists. Detroit plates going too fast. Bull moose on the road, smacked straight into it. Crushed the car."
It was a family, the parents plus two young children. The man was on the examination table, and Ian's father was trying to get a tube down his throat. The mother was on the trestle table on the other side of the room, moaning faintly. Margie was bending over one of the children, a little boy who was spread out on Dr. Christofferson's desk. The other child, hardly more than a baby, was the one making the noise. At least it meant his heart and lungs were working. He was on a pile of blankets on the floor. There was a bandage around his head, but blood was leaking through it, and his face was covered in blood. He was pulling at the bandage and screaming hysterically.
"Deal with the bleeding," Ian's father said, nodding at the child. "Then see if you can calm him down."
"Is it okay to pick him up?"
"Yes, but support his head. Jerry, I need you here."
It was after midnight by the time the ambulance had taken the children and their parents off to the hospital. Ian and his father sat in the kitchen, listening to the silence. Ian wondered if the baby's screams were going to echo in his head for the rest of his life.
"I think a cup of tea is in order," Dr. Christofferson said after a long while. "By way of celebration. All four of them should make it."
He heaved himself to his feet. His face looked drawn, the skin sagging with fatigue. He'd been called out twice the previous night and had been working 16 hours straight. The measles epidemic hadn't burned itself out yet, and weekends meant nothing. The little coal of anger, 3 years old now and lying dormant most of the time, flared up in Ian, amazing how he could still go from barely a glimmer to white-hot rage in a matter of seconds. Anger born of guilt. Anger born of the unjustness of the guilt. In a couple of months' time, his father was going to be alone here. What would he do on a night like tonight?
"You need another nurse."
"Yeah, you could be right."
His father set the kettle on the stove.
"You did well with that little lad tonight, by the way. You have a real way with them."
"You need to advertise for another one right now," Ian said. "Right now, first thing in the morning." He was so mad all at once. He was almost shaking. His father put a hand on his shoulder. He said quietly, "Ian, things are going to be fine here. You don't need to worry about me. Things are going to be fine." She had stopped writing to him, and he was glad. She had phoned him on his birthday back in May and cried down the phone line so he'd hung up on her. There had been one final letter after that, and then nothing. He missed the act of throwing the unopened envelopes away. Over the years of her absence, he had received 192 letters from her, and the ritual of throwing them away unread had given him great satisfaction. But when they stopped coming, he was glad. He still looked for them in the mailbox, but when they weren't there, he was glad. He had to go to the farm. It was very late, but he knew he wouldn't sleep otherwise. He was still too angry, too stirred up. He waited until his father had gone to bed and then got on his bike. The moon was up and the night had an eerie brightness. The road looked unreal, insubstantial as a ribbon, as if at any moment it might unstick itself from the ground and lift off into the air. When he got to the woods surrounding the farm, he left his bike in its usual place and made his way through the woods on foot. While he was still some way off, he saw a light flickering, which meant that Jake, it was sure to be Jake, was still up. Ian felt a surge of irritation. He would have preferred him not to be there, not to be in the house at all. It got in the way of the sense of calm he used to find there. When he got close, though, there didn't seem to be anyone in the kitchen. Ian moved around, trying to see into the corners of the room. He wasn't taking much care to be quiet, so he got a serious fright when he suddenly saw the glow of a cigarette outside the back door. Jake must be standing on the doorstep. In fact, now that he knew he was there, Ian could make out his shape. Jake didn't move, though. The dogs were wandering around. They came up behind Ian, waving their tails, so maybe he assumed the noise was them. The cigarette glowed and died a few times, and then Ian saw him drop it onto the doorstep, grind it out with his shoe, and brush it over the edge. A moment later, Jake turned around and went in. He didn't seem to be in any hurry to go to bed. In the kitchen, he lit another cigarette and sat down in an armchair by the fire. It looked as if he could be there a while. Ian fidgeted. He was about to give up and go home when Laura appeared. She didn't come into the kitchen, just stood in the doorway. She was wearing a dressing gown tied tightly around her waist and was holding it closed at the neck with one hand. Jake smiled at her and said something. She shook her head. She said something, something urgent, it seemed to Ian, because she leaned forward as she spoke. Jake tipped his head to one side and made some reply. He looked quite relaxed. Whatever Laura had said didn't worry him. She shook her head again, still clutching the neck of her dressing gown. She was upset about something. Ian was sure of it. Then Jake stood up. He stubbed out his cigarette in a saucer on the table, taking his time over it, mashing the butt into the saucer several times, and then started to cross the kitchen toward her, smiling, as if to reassure her. Laura turned abruptly and left the room. For a moment, Jake stood where he was, looking at the empty doorway. Then he went back to the chair and sat down. He fished out another cigarette, lit it, and started smoking, his head resting against the back of the chair. Ian realized he had been holding his breath. He didn't know what to make of it. Laura's posture, the way she left so fast when Jake came toward her, it was as if she was really upset with him, or even afraid of him, though that seemed ridiculous. He walked back through the woods to his bike, mulling it over. It made him uneasy. It made him wonder what Jake was playing at. Why exactly he was here. They'd been fishing for a couple of hours when Pete suddenly said, "Oh, nearly forgot." He reached under his seat and hauled out a small shoebox from among the clutter of fishing tackle and beer bottles. The box was the flimsy sort they put moccasins in to sell to tourists at the trading post. It was soggy along the bottom from lying in bilge water and looked in danger of disintegrating. Ian wedged the handle of his fishing rod into a hole in the Queen Mary's floorboards, took the box, one hand underneath it to stop it from falling apart, and opened it. Inside, crouched down among some dead grass and a little pebbled heap of dung, was a very small gray rabbit.
"Wow," Ian said. "Is he ever cute? Where'd you find him?"
"Near the trap line."
"He's tiny. Are you sure he's old enough to leave his mother?"
Pete stuck a minnow on his hook and dropped it overboard. "We ate her last night, man, so it's kind of an academic question." "Oh," Ian said. He stroked the rabbit gently behind the ears. Its fur was so soft he could scarcely feel it. The rabbit quivered and flattened itself against the floor of the box.
"Poor thing," he said. "This isn't a big enough box, either."
"What are you talking about?" Pete said. "It's a perfect fit."
"He doesn't even have room to turn around," Ian said. "I thought you guys were supposed to have this special thing with animals, a respectful relationship, like asking their forgiveness before shooting them, that sort of thing."
Pete gave him a look. He reached out and took the box, one hand still holding the jig over the side of the boat. He put his head down to the box and said,
"Hey, Wabbit, forgive me, man. I'm sorry I had to eat your mum and stuff you in a shoebox."
He handed the box back to Ian. "There you go. He feels better about everything now." He bobbed the jig up and down in the water. Back at home, Ian went up to the attic and rummaged around in the clutter. There wasn't anything perfect, but he found a box that would do. It was nearly as flimsy as the shoebox, and the sides weren't as tall as he would have liked, but the rabbit didn't look like much of an escape artist, and at least it would have room to roam around a bit. He took the box outside, put a saucer of water at one end, covered the bottom with a thick layer of grass and leaves, and decanted the rabbit into it. It looked even smaller in there. It flattened itself down and closed its eyes, as if it were praying for a speedy end. He was sorry he'd asked for it. March would love it, if it lasted long enough to give it to him. But he'd probably cuddle it to death within a couple of hours. Killed by love. Well, maybe it was better than being eaten. He decided to delay giving it to March for a few days, though. He'd let it have a little peace before its next adventure. It would be a shame for both the boy and the rabbit if it died on the spot. He would put the box around the back of the house where it would get the morning sun but wouldn't bake in the afternoon. In the meantime, he'd get some chicken wire and work out how to make a run for it. It would need to be a big one, with a hatch the rabbit could hide in. March could help him make it.
"We're going to have a zoo," his father said later that evening. Ian had brought him out to admire the rabbit. "I had a call from Ernie Schwartz. His bitch had a litter 6 weeks ago, and he said we could come and choose a pup this weekend if we liked."
"No kidding," Ian said. "An Irish setter?"
"Yes, Ernie says it has a pedigree. I told him that was more than we had, and we didn't want to pay a fortune for it, and he said he didn't want a fortune, and he wanted me to tear up the bill for setting his daughter's leg."
"Oh," Ian said. "Is that okay?"
"I'd forgotten all about the bill, so I suppose so."
"You need a secretary as well as a nurse."
"I just need to get myself organized."
"Pigs might fly," Ian said. His father sighed. "By the way," Ian said, "I've decided what I'm going to do next year." As he said it, he felt a kind of ache mid-chest.
"Oh, yes," his father said. "What have you decided?"
"I'm going to be a pilot." His father looked at him, then looked away. Ian had been half afraid he might laugh, like Pete, but he didn't. He crouched down and began to examine the rabbit.
"A pilot," he said, after a moment. "That's an interesting career. Good for you."
He didn't look up.
Ian said, "It's what I really want to do."
"Good," his father said.
"Excellent. Then you must do it. It sounds very good."
He moved the saucer with the water in it closer to the rabbit.
"I'll have to go and talk to Mr. Hardy about it," Ian said.
The ache had spread outward, filling his entire chest now, tightening his throat.
"I don't know how I go about applying, like where you go to train, that sort of thing."
"No," his father said.
"No, neither do I. Get Hardy onto it. He'll know."
He looked up finally and smiled.
"It sounds like an interesting career. Good for you."
By rights, he should have dreamed about his father that night. But instead, as he slipped down into sleep, Jake's car rolled smoothly into the farmyard, and the passenger door opened, and Ian's mother stepped out, her legs long and elegant in high-heeled shoes. Ian was standing by the water trough, but she paid no attention to him. She picked her way through the dust of the farmyard and went into the house and sat down in the armchair Jake usually sat in. She took a pack of cigarettes out of her purse and lit one. Ian was standing by the table. He must have followed her into the house. She looked at him with a little smile and said, "Tell Laura she doesn't have to worry about Arthur. Arthur will be fine."
Chapter 12. 16 district men among casualties. Community mourns. District man collects $80 on dead bears. Temiskaming speaker, October 1944. October. The skies a pale, lifeless gray, the fields stripped bare, everything holding its breath clenched against the coming cold. Jake's pursuit of Laura was nicely underway, and all Arthur could do was stand and watch.
"He says your father was a wonderful man," Laura said.
They were in Otto's barn. Arthur and the two POWs were preparing winter quarters for the pigs. It had snowed the previous night, and any day now they'd have to move all the animals inside. Laura had just arrived home from school and had brought mugs of tea out for the three of them. The boys were sitting on bales of straw, warming their hands on the mugs. Arthur and Laura stood in the doorway, Laura leaning against the door, her arms wrapped tightly around her to keep out the cold. She was wearing an old coat of her father's and had a long red scarf wound several times around her neck. It was coming on for dusk, and the light was seeping out of the sky, draining the color out of everything as it went, everything it seemed to Arthur, except the bright flame of that scarf. Laura said, "He says you're exactly like him. He says you've been wonderful since he died, the way you've run the farm, both farms, all by yourself, the way you've provided for him and your mother. He says he's worse than useless, no help to you at all." She smiled, to show that she knew that wasn't true, that Jake did everything he could. Arthur looked at the ground. Sometimes he could hardly bear to be near her. "He told me how you saved his life, Arthur," she said, "how you risked your own life wading out into the river and then carried him home in your arms." Had Jake sat down and worked out the best way to win her over? Had he studied her, thought about who she was and how she'd been raised, and decided on the best strategy, or was it just another thing that Jake was born knowing? He and Laura walked to and from school together every day now, half an hour each way, 5 hours a week alone in her company, telling her the version of things he wanted her to hear, painting the picture he wanted her to see. "He says you're the one your mother depends on," Laura said another time, her voice full of pity and admiration for Jake. It was true. That was what was so clever about it. Arthur had known it for years without ever putting it into words. He was the one his mother depended on. Jake was the one she loved. Sometimes when he looked at Laura, he was almost paralyzed with the fear of losing her. He could hardly get his breath, sometimes, which was strange. How could you be so terrified of losing something you didn't have? Other things were going on in the world. Major historic things that were of infinitely greater importance than the small matter of one man's love for a woman who was being stolen by his brother. In the middle of November, a grainy picture of a battleship called the Tirpitz was taped to the window of the post office so that everybody could see it, though you couldn't actually see much for the billows of black smoke pouring out of the belly of the ship. It was the very last German battleship, so they said, and now it was at the bottom of the sea. The war was nearly over, and Hitler was on the run. A few months back, the RAF had dropped more than 2,000 tons of bombs on Berlin in one night. There couldn't be anything left of it but dust. Any day now, peace would be declared, and everything would return to how it was before. Everyone knew, though, that nothing would be as it was before. Not for anyone. The prison camp guard arrived one morning not long before Christmas with letters for the boys. They excused themselves immediately after lunch and took them to the parlor, which was their bedroom, to read. Usually, when they got letters, they read bits out to each other, and if you were in the kitchen, you would hear them jabbering away, even laughing sometimes at bits of family news. It was Arthur's mother who noticed that there wasn't any jabbering this time.
"They're very quiet," she said suddenly.
Arthur looked up from the buckle he was sewing on a harness. It was true, there wasn't a sound from the parlor. He and his mother looked at each other, he with the pliers poised to pull the needle through, she with her hands in the sink.
"Do you think,"
his mother said, but at that moment Dieter Bernhardt appeared in the doorway. His face was strained.
"Dieter's brother," he said, "is tot, dead. He is killed."
"Oh," Arthur's mother said, "oh, the poor child."
She was already halfway across the room, drying her hands on a tea towel as she went. The boy, Bernhard, this must be the one who drove Otto's tractor, finally Arthur knew which was which, stood aside, and she went into the parlor. She'd have her arms around Dieter in a second, Arthur knew. It was so easy for women. Their arms opened out instinctively, and they gathered in whatever hurt there was, and that was that. They didn't even have to think about it. Arthur and Bernhard looked at each other helplessly, then looked away. A few lucky men came home on leave for Christmas. You'd have thought that if the war was nearly over, as they kept saying it was, they could call it quits now and let everyone go home for good. But no, the best they could do was give some of them 30 days' leave before sending them back to the slaughter. Then, the week before Christmas, Ted Hatchett did come home for good. Of the truckload of boys who had gone down to North Bay to enlist, he was the only one, apart from Arthur himself, who was still alive.
"You must go see him, Arthur," his mother said, though he knew that all too well himself.
Apparently he nearly died. He was in the hospital in England for a whole year, but he's well enough to see people now. He'll feel strange being back. You must visit him." Arthur went, full of guilt and foreboding. What could he say? What could he say to a friend who had nearly died in battle while he himself had stayed safe and snug at home? Ted had been overseas for nearly 5 years, 5 years of being shot at and bombed, of being soaking wet and freezing cold and having your friends blown to pieces around you. 5 years during which Arthur had done what exactly? Milked the cows? Slept in his own bed every night? Eaten 3 good meals a day? He trudged through the snow, filled with dread. Ted's mother looked terrible, and he should have been warned by that. Should have realized something was badly wrong when she wasn't dancing with relief and joy that her son had come home from war. She managed to smile at Arthur when she opened the door, but didn't say anything. She ushered him into the living room, where a bed had been made up in the corner, and then left him and Ted alone. It was dark in the living room, and Arthur couldn't make out Ted's face. He said, "Hiya, Ted, how are you?" before his eyes adjusted to the light. There was a scar running down the right side of Ted's face, with a stretch of shiny pink skin covering the eye socket. And as Arthur's eyes adjusted to the dim room, he saw more, saw that the blankets were stretched smooth and flat across the bed, smooth and flat as a tabletop where Ted's legs should have been. And that where his left arm should have been there was an empty sleeve folded and pinned across his chest. He was looking at Arthur out of one eye, so savagely bright, it made Arthur think of an animal caught in a trap, an animal you'd kill as quickly as you could put an end to its pain. Arthur turned around and left the room. In the kitchen, he stopped, head down, breathing hard. Ted's mother was peeling potatoes and crying into the sink. She looked at Arthur, her face all blotchy with grief, and said, "Talk to him, Arthur, please talk to him." Arthur went back to the living room and tried again. He managed to say, "I'm real sorry," but that was it. He stood for a minute with his face averted, and then he turned and went home. He was sick with himself, sick with the world. He wanted to smash something, anything, cleave something in two. He started clearing land. A couple of acres he and his father had just begun working on when his father died. More land to farm was the last thing he needed right now, but hacking down trees was the only job he could think of that was violent enough to ease his feelings. Partway through the first afternoon, he looked up from the pit of a root he was digging out and saw Dieter and Bernhard looking down at him. They were carrying axes, too. They must have raided the shed. And such was his state of mind that for a moment Arthur thought they had come to kill him. It seemed entirely right. He wouldn't even have resisted. Then they pointed their axes at the nearby trees and raised their eyebrows, and he saw they felt the need for a bit of violence too, so he nodded and waved a hand at the surrounding bush. "Go ahead, hack 'em all down. Rip the small ones out by the roots, the more the better." For 3 days, while snow drifted softly down around them, they attacked the forest like a raging storm, chopped and sawed, then harnessed up all 4 horses and dragged roots out of the ground like rotting teeth, till the place looked like their very own battlefield, cratered and ruined and smashed to bloody pulp. At dusk, on the third day, Jake appeared, limping through the trees like a pale ghost. Arthur saw him coming out of the corner of his eye. He was in mid-swing, about to take another blow at the smooth, rounded skin of a beech tree, and suddenly he saw blood on the snow. A big splash of blood, red as Laura's scarf. He closed his eyes for a moment, the axe still raised, and when he opened them again it wasn't blood, It was just a big clod of churned-up earth, black as night, not red at all. He lowered the axe and looked at Jake. The shock of seeing Ted Hatchet had actually succeeded in driving the business of Jake and Laura out of his mind for several days, but now it was back. Jake met his eyes, and there was a pause, during which Arthur wondered if maybe Jake had seen blood on the snow as well. "What?" Arthur said, and Jake said quietly that their mother wanted them to stop now and put everything away, because tomorrow was not only Sunday, it was Christmas Eve. There were two services, one in the morning and one in the evening. The church was crammed for both of them. Even those who weren't normally among the faithful turned out on Christmas Eve. It didn't feel very festive, though. 5 years of war had drained the capacity for festive feeling out of people. The war might be coming to an end in theory, but in practice the telegrams were still arriving, and peace was just an unreal dream. At the morning service, Reverend March did his best, preaching a sermon about the Christmas gift of hope and about giving your pain to God. Arthur would have liked to be uplifted by it, but wasn't. He didn't feel hopeful about anything, and the bit about giving your pain to God made him think of Ted Hatchet. He imagined Ted holding out his pain to God with the one hand he had left. "Here you go, God, it's all yours." What happened next, exactly? Arthur couldn't see for the life of him how it was supposed to help. He knew that Reverend March was smarter than he was, so he should take it on trust, but he couldn't. So he gave up and watched Laura instead. She was in her usual pew at the front of the church, and Arthur had positioned himself, as he always did, so that he had a clear view of her back. Her back was very straight and slim and upright. Looking at it calmed him, and after a while the thought came to Arthur that the bit in her father's sermon about hope might have something in it after all. Maybe he could hope where Laura was concerned. Maybe he had been wrong to be so fearful about her and Jake. Just look at her sitting there, listening so intently to what her father was saying. She wasn't Jake's kind of girl. In fact, if you tried to imagine the absolute opposite of Jake's kind of girl, Laura would be it. Jake would have had no interest in her whatsoever if he hadn't seen that Arthur was in love with her. He liked girls with what he called a little bit of fun in them, by which he meant girls who would accompany him to the barn. Laura would never accompany Jake to a barn in a million years. And he must know that. Jake, sitting on the other side of their mother now, thinking about God knew what, must know that. He was probably tired of her already. He was just doing what Jake had always done. He was saying, "Bet you. Bet you I can take her away from you. Bet you I'm better than you at this, like I'm better than you at everything." When he had tortured Arthur a little more, he would drop her and move on, and maybe Laura would be sad for a couple of days, but then she'd see Jake for what he really was and be relieved that he was gone. All day that thought comforted him. He went over to Otto's farm after lunch to see to the pigs. Sunday or not, Christmas Eve or not, the animals had to be fed. And Laura waved cheerily to him from the kitchen window. Pleasure washed over Arthur like sunshine. It was going to be all right. It was after the evening service when Reverend March was standing at the back of the church shaking hands with his congregation and wishing them a Merry Christmas that Arthur saw Jake come up to Laura and whisper something to her. Arthur was standing with his mother, waiting his turn to shake the Reverend's hand, so he had a good view. He saw Jake come up behind her and bend his head and whisper in her ear. Laura's eyes widened a little and she flushed, and then she turned and looked up at him, and smiled. Was it the smile that did it, that caused the cold snake of fear to coil around Arthur's heart, or the angle of her chin as she turned her face upward to look at Jake? Or was it simply the light that came into her eyes when she heard his whisper, the brightness, the happiness, the pure and unmistakable yearning in those clear gray eyes? He couldn't look at Jake, couldn't be in the same room with him. He spent as much time as possible out in the barns, but the weather didn't cooperate. In the middle of January, the temperature hit 40 below. If you stayed outside for more than a couple of minutes, you could feel the marrow freezing in your bones. In desperation, Arthur took to visiting Ted Hatchett. He'd go and sit with him for an hour or so in the afternoons. It was impossible to say if Ted welcomed the visits, but his mother certainly did. She was so grateful, it made Arthur ashamed. He was there to get away from Jake and to ease his own guilt. And also because in Ted's presence everything, including life itself, seemed trivial, and there was a certain bleak comfort in that. He could never think of anything to say, of course. He sat there racking his brains for some event he could tell Ted about. Not a whole lot was going on. "Pigs chewed through the barn door last night." Ted turned his head slowly and looked at him. It was hard to tell if he was interested. The Hatchetts weren't farmers. Ted's father had worked in the sawmill, and Ted himself in the silver mine, so he might not care all that much about pigs. But it was the only thing that had happened all week. "They ain't hungry," Arthur explained. "Just bored. They hate being inside. They like rooting about in the soil, looking for bugs and such. Gotta give 'em lots of straw to root about in the winter, or they go nuts and start eating the barn. Boys didn't put down enough straw yesterday." Ted said nothing. As far as anyone knew, there was nothing physically preventing Ted from talking, but apparently he hadn't said a word since he was wounded. He'd been a tank gunner, Arthur knew a few more details now from his mother, and had been somewhere in Italy. The tank hit a mine and blew up, and everyone else in it had died. "Floor of the barn's concrete, see? Can't root about in concrete." Ted blinked his one eye. Arthur took it as encouragement. "Cows don't mind so much. Seem pretty happy just standing there doing nothing." He stopped. It struck him.